going to Psalm 28. Continuing our Bible study here through the Psalms. Psalm number 28. Summary for this psalm. Psalm 28 calls on God to save His covenant people who have trusted in Him. Go over that again. Psalm 28 calls on God to save His covenant people who have trusted in Him. Outline for this psalm, verses 1 to 5, prayer for deliverance. Verses 6 to 9, praise for deliverance. So I'll go over that one more time. Verses 1 to 5, prayer for deliverance. Verses 6 to 9, praise for deliverance. All right, so we'll go to observations on Psalm 28. Psalm 28 was written by David. As you see, the superscription there, a psalm of David. There's no occasion that is mentioned. There's no musical direction that's given in the superscription or in the text of the psalm itself. Psalm 28 is a lament, and it's a lament that moves from an individual lament to a corporate lament. Oftentimes in Psalms, as far as categories would go, laments either fall into one or the other. There are a few that blend both, and this is one of them. I think some of the Psalms we've looked at before have been that way as well. So being a lament, it's going to follow in the conventions of a lament, that it's going to have a call to God, it's going to have a request for deliverance. So those conventions, verses 1 and 2, call to God, verse 3, a request for deliverance, verses 4 and 5, which give the crisis or the complaint of the lament, verses 6 and 7, confidence and praise for prayer heard, and verses 8 and 9, confident prayer for God's covenant people. So it is does have a little bit of variance from that, but it falls generally into those conventions. Psalm 28 also has some wisdom elements in it, and that particularly can be seen with references, verses 4 and 5, references to the wicked receiving their reward or being rewarded according to their works, being rewarded by what they deserve for the evil of their works. Now, Psalm 28 shares a number of connections with actually Psalms 23 through 27, and it's most closely connected with Psalm 27. So just to see some of those connections there, we have calling on the Lord in verse 1 here and in verse 7 of Psalm 27. We have God as a rock here in verse 1 and in Psalm 27, verse 5. We have God's silence or hiding of face in verse 1 and in Psalm 27, verse 9. We have mercy in verses 2 and 6. And the word here is translated supplication, which is a prayer or a cry or a plea for mercy. Mercy in verses 2 and 6 and in Psalm 27, 7. We have the house or temple, which remember we've pointed out how in this section of the Psalms, there's a grouping here that several of them in a row make some sort of reference to God's house, God's tabernacle, God's temple, something along that line. So here in verse 2, as well as in Psalm 27, verses 4 to 6, we have God as a helper here in verse 7, as well as in Psalm 27, verse 9. God is a fortress in verses 7 and 8 here, as well as in Psalm 27, 1. And we also have joy and praise here in verse 7, as well as in Psalm 27, verse 6. So there's a number of connections between this and the previous psalm. Considering the poetic features of Psalm 28, it's not necessarily an extremely rich in poetic features. It does use repetition, which is very common in Hebrew poetry, but it does use repetition. So you'll see repetition of supplication in verse 2 and 6, the repetition of the lifting up in verse 2 and 9. Some of these repetitions are parallel, that the repetition is both positive. Sometimes it's contrast, so that one is positive and one is negative. For instance, the repetition of works. So in verses 3 and 4, you have works, the works of the wicked, the deeds of the wicked, and we have them contrasted with the works of God in verse 5. We have hands, which is similar, verses 4 and 5. We also have the repetition of bless, blessing, blessed, there in verses 6 and 9. We also do have some imagery in Psalm 28. We have the pit in verse 1, which refers literally to a pit that's dug like a hole for a cistern. It could be something that could be dug as a hole to put a prisoner in or something in. But that is usually associated with death, and particularly death in judgment, so that there's a divine separation of going into the pit. We have images like God as a rock, God as a shield, God as a fortress or strength or a strong place, verses 1, 7, and 8. And then we also have the imagery of a shepherd in verse number 9, and we'll talk about that. That comes through the word feed there in verse number 9. Okay, so let's walk through this psalm. Let's read these 9 verses. Unto thee will I cry, O Lord, my rock. Be not silent to me, lest if thou be silent to me, I become like them that go down into the pit. Hear the voice of my supplications when I cry unto thee. When I lift up my hands toward thy holy oracle, draw me not away with the wicked and with the workers of iniquity, which speak peace to their neighbors, but mischief is in their hearts. Give them according to their deeds, and according to the wickedness of their endeavors. Give them after the work of their hands. Render to them their desert. Because they regard not the works of the Lord, nor the operation of his hands, he shall destroy them and not build them up. Blessed be the Lord, because he hath heard the voice of my supplications. The Lord is my strength and my shield, my heart trusted in him, and I am helped. Therefore my heart greatly rejoiceth, and with my song will I praise him. The Lord is their strength, and he is the saving strength of his anointed. Save thy people, and bless thine inheritance. Feed them also, and lift them up forever. All right, so verses 1 and 2 are the direct call to God, which is a typical opening for a lament. The opening line expresses exclusivity. In other words, unto thee will I cry, O Lord. Essentially is expressing that he will cry to no other. Only to the Lord is he going to cry. Only to the Lord is he going to pray. Referring to the Lord as a rock, the rock being, which could refer to a cliff or some sort of an elevated mountain or large boulder, but basically the imagery is that the rock is a place of security and a place of defense. And this is what he calls the Lord, Yahweh, my rock. The word for silent, be not silent to me, it appears there twice in verse number 1. And it's a word that can mean silent and not speaking. It's a word that can also mean to be deaf or to not hearing. And obviously in the context, that is the context of hearing David's cry. So when he's saying, be not silent, not talking about God not speaking to him. He's talking about God not hearing him. So don't be silent to me. Don't be deaf to me. Don't refuse to hear me when I cry. So if God is deaf to David's cry, then notice what he says there. I will become like them that go down into the pit. He will become like them that go down into the pit. So going into the pit, again, is that like a hole or a cistern? But the image is as a place of death, and it's a place of being cut off from the living in judgment. So he says, I will become like them that go. In other words, the wicked that die in their evil sins, and they go to the pit in their judgment and to the place they're cut off of the land of the living. He says, if the Lord doesn't hear my cry, then I'm going to be like them, is what he says. In verse 2, he's requesting to be heard. Hear the voice of my supplications when I cry unto thee, when I lift up my hands toward the holy oracle. So he's requesting to be heard. The word for supplication, again, is a word that means it's a plea for mercy, a supplication. It's an old word that we don't really use anymore, but it's a word that means to plead for mercy. And it is accompanied here by the lifting up of hands, which indicates prayer. Now, the word for oracle is a word that means sanctuary. And so it is a reference, actually, thy holy oracle, thy holy sanctuary, is a reference that otherwise is made to the most holy place of the tabernacle and later of the temple. Verse 3, then, gives the prayer for deliverance. Draw me not away with the wicked and with the workers of iniquity. So he is asking for deliverance from the fate of the wicked. And we've seen prayers like this already in the Psalms that we've covered, not to be gathered with the wicked in judgment, not to be counted among them or numbered among them. So he's praying to be delivered from the fate of the wicked, which echoes what he said in verse number 1, that if God doesn't hear and doesn't deliver him, he will be like the wicked in judgment. Workers of iniquity are characterized in this verse by the deceit to their neighbors. They speak peace, or they speak shalom to their neighbors, but they have mischief or evil or some sort of sinful purpose in their hearts. This is very similar to that of the false witnesses we saw in Psalm 27:12. He goes on with the complaint in verses 4 and 5. So after asking to be delivered from them, then he's asking for judgment on them. And we see repetition in these verses. So we have repetition of the wicked, their deeds, their endeavors, the works of their hands. All very similar things, though they are different. But what he's saying is that they're guilty of evil works. They're guilty of evil actions. And by contrast, he also says in verse 5 that they don't regard the works of the Lord. In other words, their own works are evil, and they don't discern or understand the works that God does. They don't see those and praise those as righteous. So again, they're guilty of evil acts themselves, and they're guilty of refusing to acknowledge the righteous works of God. And so their judgment means, in verse 5, that God will destroy them. And the destruction of them, you can see this as a reference to a final judgment, because it says that they will not be built up. They won't, in other words, they won't rise up from that judgment when God rises up to destroy them. They will not rise up from that judgment. Now, in verses 6 and 7, we see the turn in this lament. We see praise that is issued for being heard. The request to be heard in verse 2 has been answered. Blessed be the Lord, because he hath heard the voice of my supplications. Now, being heard by God is something that we have seen a number of times in the Psalms already, and it is the blessed privilege of the righteous. It is the blessed privilege of those who trust in the Lord, being heard when they cry. So we have references to that in Psalm 4, 5, 6, 10, 17, 18, and 22. And all of these are references to those that are righteous, those that are just being heard. This is the privilege of those that trust in the Lord. He's expressing confidence in these verses through Yahweh's praiseworthy attributes, resulting in thanksgiving and praise. So he refers to God as a strength and as a shield. And so these are images that refer to God's protection and His defense and His deliverance of those who trust in Him from all enemies. Like all of these words evoke images of security and being secure and being delivered again from those that would attack and would seek to destroy. He also refers to the fact that he was helped in verse number 7. And the same word is used in a couple of other psalms, Psalm 10 and verse 14. And there, God is referred to as a helper, essentially, of the helpless. He's a helper of those who cannot help themselves. And in Psalm 22 and verse number 11, that great messianic psalm that we looked at, he is a helper when there is no other help. In other words, he's a helper that helps when none can help. There's none with ability to help except the Lord. So this is what David says and praises the Lord as being his helper. Then we get to verses 8 and 9, and we see that this prayer is extended, and it's extended. This is where we move beyond that individual lament to a community or a corporate lament. Yahweh is said to be the strength of His people. He is their strength, and this is expressed through the saving of the anointed. It says He is the saving strength of His anointed. So the deliverance of the anointed means the deliverance of His people. So the saving of the anointed is the saving of the people. You notice it refers to God's people in verse 9 and refers to them as His inheritance, praying for God to save and to bless His inheritance. Now, this is particularly spoken of God's covenant people. So if we look at a place like Deuteronomy chapter number 9, Deuteronomy chapter number 9 and verse 29 says, "Yet are they thy people and thine inheritance, which thou broughtest out by thy mighty power and by thy stretched out arm." Now, this is early in the psalm. This is when Moses is recounting the Exodus from Egypt. And he's referring to this intercessory prayer. When Moses prayed for God not to destroy his people, he did it on the basis of God's covenant. And basically what Moses was praying there was saying, "Lord, this is your inheritance." In other words, this is the people you created by your covenant. This is the people you created. This is your inheritance. This is your portion. So don't destroy them. That was Moses' prayer. If we flip forward in Deuteronomy chapter 32, we have Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse number 9. We have this statement, "For the Lord's portion is His people. Jacob is the lot of His inheritance." So when we have David, who is the anointed king of Israel, praying for God to save His people, which are His inheritance. So in other words, this is the people of Israel, those offspring of Abraham that he is referring to, particularly to his covenant people. And notice also that it uses the shepherd imagery, verse 9. That word for feed is a word that means to pasture or to tend to a flock or to herd. And it's a word that it's very common in the Old Testament, and it is translated in many instances, it is translated by shepherd. And so this is shepherd imagery that is being used to pasture, to feed, to tend a flock of sheep. And it's imagery that is expanded here. Notice this, "and lift them up forever." So the idea is of carrying. So we have this imagery of the shepherd that was introduced in Psalm 23. But here we even see it expanded to speak of the carrying of the sheep. And we know that one of the jobs of the shepherd in caring for his sheep especially oftentimes with little ones, if they were going through an area that was too hard for them, too rough for them, or even too dangerous for them to try to walk on their own, the shepherd would carry them. And of course, you know, the parable that Jesus told about the 99 sheep and the one that was lost, and the shepherd went out and searched until he found, and then he came back carrying that sheep. So this was something common, but this is also common language that was used to speak to Israel. So for instance, Isaiah chapter number 46. Now in this section of Isaiah's prophecy, Isaiah is actually prophesying against idols, and he is denouncing idol worship. And here we even have a contrast between idols, because Isaiah tells Israel to look at the nations around them. They're worshiping and trusting in these idols that they have to carry around and set up from place to place. He said, that's not the case with you and the Lord. He carries you. You don't carry him. So notice this in Isaiah 46, just a rich verse or rich passage. Baal boweth down, Nebo stoopeth. Their idols were upon the beasts and upon the cattle. Your carriages were heavy loaden. They are a burden to the weary beast. They stoop, they bow down together. They could not deliver the burden, but themselves are gone into captivity. Hearken unto me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me from the belly, which are carried from the womb. Even to your old age I am he, and even to hoar hairs will I carry you. I have made, and I will bear, even I will carry, and will deliver you. Of course, he goes on making other comparisons and contrasts between the God of Israel and between the idols of the nations. So that imagery of the shepherd is expanded here in Psalm 28 to include that shepherd carrying his flock, his people. All right, so let's move to interpretation for Psalm 28. What does Psalm 28 teach? Well, Psalm 28 teaches about God's justice, or we could say God's righteous justice. But justice, actually, the word for righteousness and justice are very, very close in their meaning. So what we see in this psalm is we see the wicked, and we see workers of iniquity, and we see that they will receive what they deserve for their evil deeds and their evil works. Right? You see that very plainly in verses 3-5. So they're going to receive a reward or a repayment, and we could even say vengeance from the Lord. They're going to receive a judgment that's going to destroy them, and that speaks obviously of the finality of judgment. So their works are going, they're going to be dealt with according to their works. All right, so here we see God as judge of the wicked, giving them what their works deserve. By contrast, in Psalm 28, we have his people, his inheritance, those that trust in him. And by contrast, he is a rock for them. He is a hearer of their supplications. He is a strength and a shield. He is a help who will bless, feed, and carry forever those who trust in him. And of course, we've seen that word for trust shown up in a number of the Psalms. And we've also noted, as we've been going through and will continue to do so, that it is that the word has a covenantal association. Those who trust in the Lord, those who have put their trust in the Lord, they are in a covenant relationship with him. And those who trust him, those who are in covenant relationship with him, he is a rock and a shield and a fortress and a shepherd. And so the prayer in this psalm is David doesn't ask God, stand me up beside these others that are wicked and judge my righteous works and judge their wicked works, condemn them and deliver me. Not at all. That's not at all what David prays here. He does pray for the wicked to be judged according to their works. But he asks not to be gathered with the wicked. In other words, he said, if the Lord doesn't hear him, he said, I'll go down and get down into the pit. In other words, if I'm judged along with the wicked, I'm no better than they. My fate will be no different than theirs. But his prayer is not to be gathered with the wicked. In other words, the difference is plainly shown in this psalm, that the difference is God's mercy and God's covenant faithfulness. He will be delivered because the Lord is his rock and his strength and his shield, because he has put his trust in the Lord, and the Lord will feed and will carry him. That is the difference between him and the wicked. It is God's covenant and that relationship that he has with God because he has trusted in him. So this psalm does teach us much about God's justice, how that God is, we could say God is holy and righteous, and mankind is not. And if man receives what his works deserve, he's going to be destroyed. And the only escape then is going to be through the Lord, that is a help for those who trust in him. So we do learn much about God's justice. All right, so let's talk about the messianic hope. And this is, as we've been going through the Psalms, particularly our focus, and we talked about that as we got started in the Psalms, but our focus is that biblical theology concern. In other words, particularly the messianic hope in these Psalms. And what is the story that these Psalms are telling us, not just individually, but as a whole? And that's the reason why we're looking at all these connections with the other Psalms and how they're interconnected, how they use the they repeat images and themes and things, and you know, together, what are they telling us? So we do want to consider the messianic hope in Psalm number 28. All right, well, the lament that we experience in the Psalms has a certain covenantal structure that resolves in the salvation of his covenant people. And that's common in the laments, and it is also here in Psalm 28. So if we look at Psalm 28, we can actually take this prayer and we can actually just put it into a covenant structure. So let's look at Genesis 12 here for just a moment. So the Psalm 28 appeals to God's grace. And we can parallel that with God's covenant of grace with Abraham. So Genesis 12:1, "Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee." It's made plain in the account in Genesis, as well as in other places in the Old Testament and references to it, that Abraham was an idolater. Abraham dwelt in darkness. And the way that Stephen put it was, the God of glory or the God of light appeared to him. In other words, it was God's grace that chose Abraham and called him out of darkness and made these promises to him. So the lament approaches God as a covenant God from the standpoint of his grace. We also have in Psalm 28 what is sometimes referred to as imprecations. Imprecations in the Psalms are calling for God's curses or God's judgment to come down on the wicked, particularly on the enemies. And a lot of people are very unsettled by those sort of prayers. But what you find is that imprecations in the Psalms are prayers that echo God's covenant promises. So what did God say here in verse 3 of Psalm 12? Speaking to Abraham, God said, "I will bless them that bless thee and curse him that curseth thee." and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So this cursing of the enemies that is prayed for in the Psalms is actually a covenantally faithful prayer. It's calling on God to keep His promises is what the call is. And then we also see in Psalm 28, in verses 6 to 9, we see the salvation and blessing of His chosen people, of His inheritance. Well, this corresponds with the promise that God made pertaining Abraham's offspring. He says in verse 2, "And I will make of thee a great nation." God said, I'm going to create a nation out of you, a people that did not exist prior. I'm going to make a nation out of you, Abraham, his offspring. And notice the words that Moses spoke to that second generation of Israelites that were going to go into the promised land, the second generation that had come out of Egypt. In Deuteronomy chapter number 7 and verse number 6, this is the way that Moses explained it to them, "For thou art a holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love upon you nor choose you because you were more in number than any people, for you were the fewest of all people. But because the Lord loved you," in other words, he loved you because he loved you. In other words, it was his sovereign will and purpose to do so. He didn't set his love on you for any reason outside of himself. And notice this, "and because he would keep the oath which he had sworn unto your fathers," that's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God renews this covenant with each one of them in the book of Genesis. "Hath the Lord brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you out of the house of bondmen from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt? Know therefore that the Lord thy God, he is God, the faithful God, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love him and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations." So this prayer is a prayer for the cursing of the enemies as well as the salvation of the chosen people. But we also want to notice that the nations are also given to the anointed son king in Psalm 2:8 as his inheritance. Very same word. Yes, he chose the nation of Israel as a particular people, but you flip back to Genesis chapter number 12 and you find what? That at the end of verse 3, God promised, "And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed." So in other words, the nations are also given to the anointed son king. The Gentiles are grafted in as other sheep that are not of the fold of Israel, according to John chapter 10 and verse number 16. So in other words, this prayer is a covenantal prayer that blesses God's people, that is first speaking of those of Israel, those of Abraham's offspring, but that is also through the blessings of the Messiah and God's new covenant extended to the Gentiles as well. Now, by the end of the psalm, the deliverance of the anointed means the deliverance of God's covenant people. Well, we've seen the term anointed used, obviously in Psalm 2 especially, though it's been repeated in Psalm 18 as well as in Psalm 20. The anointed, who's identified as God's son and God's king in Psalm number 2, that's a reference to the Messiah. Of course, the Messiah is the Hebrew term, Mashiach. It just means the anointed one. It comes over into the Greek as Christos, in which in English we say Christ. And so when we confess Christ, we are confessing that Jesus of Nazareth is the fulfillment of the promise to David of a son anointed to reign as king, Jesus Christ, the anointed one. All right, so the saving of his anointed means the deliverance of God's covenant people. So by the time we get to the end of this psalm, we realize that we need to go back and to read this whole psalm in light of the anointed, realizing that Psalm 28 is a prayer of the anointed. It's the prayer of the anointed King David, but he's a representative of the anointed son. So what do we see in this psalm? Well, we go back to verse 1 and we see abandonment. We see the forsaking. We see that theme that came out so strongly in Psalm 22. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Well, we see that reflected in verse 1 here in this psalm. We see the prayer in verse 3, not to be drawn away with the wicked. But then we realize that the Messiah was drawn away with the wicked. He was numbered with the wicked in his death and in his burial, according to Isaiah 53 and what was fulfilled in the Gospels. But this carrying away was for the sins of his people, we learn in Isaiah chapter 53. And this prayer not to be drawn away, we find that he was heard and he's not left there. Psalm 16 and Psalm 22 both tell us that. Yeah, he's drawn away with the wicked, but he's not left there. He's delivered from that. So then this lament can be seen as the intercession of the anointed for the Lord's inheritance, his people. A prayer of the Messiah. And that prayer being heard and answered, like we saw in Psalm 22 and in Psalm 16, means the deliverance of his people. We also have the shepherd imagery in this psalm. It was introduced in Psalm 23 as far as the psalms are concerned. And in the psalms, it's primarily used in connection with Israel and their deliverance. And those are mostly in the psalms of Asaph, Psalm 74, 77, 78, 79, 80, 83, and 95. Very, very rich with the imagery of the shepherd. Well, the Messiah is the shepherd who will carry his people to God's house to dwell forever. We see that in Psalm 23. That comes out later as well as in the New Testament. Places like John chapter 10, when he says that he is the good shepherd. All right. Any questions about anything there before we go to our application? Okay, application. Well, I have one primary application. Understanding Psalm 28 helps us understand our hope is in God alone. It is God's mercy. It is God's grace. It is God's covenant faithfulness that separates those who trust in Him from the wicked that are heading for judgment. It's God's mercy, grace, and covenant faithfulness. Our hope isn't founded on our strength or on our merit. And that's not the basis of this prayer at all. Our hope is also not undone by our weakness or by the bold strength of the enemies. And that's what we see in a prayer like Psalm 28. It is a total dependence on God. Right from the very, very start, if God is deaf to my cry, then I'm going to be just like those that go down to the pit without any hope and without any salvation, with none to help.